Mysterious Universe Plus Season 25, Episode 19. Coming up on the show, we've got Occult Tomb Raiders, The Warlock of Helsinki, and the spirit engineers who tried to stop Hitler. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I really do hate to be a little bit crass, but I am intrigued to know what you've got coming up on the show, because today you sent me a lot of links to suppositories of melatonin supplements.
Yes.
So why?
That was purely personal interest. Nothing to do with the show.
You know, I've always had an interest in melatonin. And I, as I told you, like, I accidentally took a little bit too much melatonin, and that was 40 milligrams. And I had like DMT kind of effects from it. The recommendation of this suppository that you sent me was 800 milligrams of melatonin.
It's from one of our listeners. It's from Chris on Twitter. He didn't recommend a suppository, but he said he was taking 200 milligrams of melatonin and he was feeling great. So I did some searching, and one of the ones that comes up is the suppository of like 250 milligrams of melatonin.
No, the other one was 800. Unless the guy that said it is like, I take, as part of his regimen, 800 milligrams of melatonin in a day. So I'm like, does that mean that he's shoving three or four suppositories?
I don't know. I didn't have time to look into it, but there's apparently some alternative doctor who claims that the dose of only, you know, 5 to 10 milligrams of melatonin is not enough. You need hundreds of milligrams. I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
I didn't really look into it.
I read a little bit of it, and it was basically highlighting like the antioxidant effects of it. He was also pointing out that people that take large doses of melatonin seem to have a significant reduction in, I think it was, kidney problems and other chronic health conditions. But I'm like, I don't know, like, melatonin really messes with you. Like,
yeah, that's true for taking 10 to 15 milligrams. But when you bump the dose up to 200 milligrams,
also,
you go over that bad feeling hump and you just go purely into the ecstasy zone where you get a great night's sleep and you feel amazing.
But what people don't realize either is, I think if you take it as a suppository, you miss the first pass mechanism, which means it's not processed by your liver first to calm it down. So not only are you getting 800 milligrams, but you're getting a full-on, unrestrained dose of the stuff.
It was funny, that company, because every second product that they sold was a suppository.
It was.
And they called them something like man bullets. Put these man bullets in your ass.
And they weren't cheap. It was like $130.
Yeah, because there's so much melatonin in there. It's like 10 times the normal dose in each suppository. We'll have to do a show on it. I didn't have time to research.
You know what? You could do that one. Because every time there's some weird product or Jung Shim energy activation, I'm always the one that gets sucked into it. So, Ben, this one could be yours.
That is
your
true.
Turn.
That
Take
is
one
true.
For the team.
I was reading a book on the HR managers for Satan today.
What?
That's what I spent most of the day doing. I was reading this book. I'll see if I can find it still in my Kindle library. But I was sending you all these screenshots. This guy wrote the book in the early 90s, and it's called Mysterious Secrets of the Dark Kingdom, The Battle for Planet Earth by J.P. Timmons. It's very full of biblical quotes, very biblical. But he's convinced that Satan is like the ultimate project manager.
Oh, yes. I was looking for that quote. That's what you sent me today.
And
wouldn't he be a program manager?
No, he's like a project manager who lives on like the 13th dimension above ours.
Well, look,
and he has all these dark angels that he directs, like a company. And they're like, one of them's the COO, one of them's the head of marketing, another one's like the head of design. And he's got to manage all these underlings underneath him.
You know what? That actually would be hell. Like, managing people is hell. So, like, that, yeah, it makes perfect sense.
And there's, like, a dark angel that's responsible for making technologies for Satan's army, and he's got this factory, and whenever someone dies on Earth, all their blood goes to this big blood bank in, like, the seventh dimension.
Theoretically, obviously.
Yeah, it was amazing because he had it all mapped out, like, Satan's company. It's like this big corporation with the way it runs, but didn't have any stories in it.
So it was like basically describing
it was like the
hierarchical structure of Satan's company.
Yeah, it was like reading about the history of Microsoft, but it just exchanged Bill Gates for Satan. And
yeah,
it was
pretty
like,
much it anyway, isn't it?
It wasn't very exciting. And I realized he had got all of his information. He's this American guy, American pastor. And he went to Nigeria. And when he came back from Nigeria, he was just completely enthralled by all these witch doctors telling him about Satan's dark cities. And I realized it's the same story. Remember we covered that story of the guy who claims that he took some potion with his father and he went to an underwater city.
That's right. He was waiting on the beach and then, yeah, there was that rock or something.
Yeah, he was sitting on a rock, he took this potion and he went out of body and went to, with his dad, he went down to this underwater city, which was basically run by Satan's demons.
Yeah.
And it was like they had iPhones and technology and cars and stuff. It was this whole other like parallel society. It's basically that without all the fun stuff.
Right, okay. So obviously that must be a well-known then folk, kind of, well, not folk, but it's a well-known tale over there, and he must have just taken that and run with it.
Yeah, culturally well understood that there are these alternative cities run by Satan's demons. There's a story in there. I've just got to find the right guy that's telling it. He was not the right guy. It was like, again, reading like a company brochure, even though it was Hell's Company.
Still, it just doesn't translate well.
But I was saved today by this new book on Finland. Called Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland by Perttu Hokkanen and Vesaliti.
Oh, I think I had that on pre-order, so I'm glad that you got
that. Too late.
I can cancel that now.
It's, well, there's tons in there. I covered one story.
Oh, okay.
One chapter, and it's this incredible story.
I did
story.
Have it on pre-order.
Yeah, too slow, buddy. So I'm going to be talking about some of the weirdness that emerged from Finland. One of them is this occult society that sprung off from the Theosophists.
Really?
Yeah, and became this Finnish version of it. I'm going to be talking today, though, about this strange spring in Helsinki where a severed hand was discovered in the 1930s, which led to this the uncovering of this huge conspiracy.
Oh.
But before I go into that, I know we missed one of your stories on the last show.
Yeah, well, I got an opportunity to dig a little bit deeper into it because I missed a really important part of the story until I dug a little bit deeper to find some background about it. And this was actually published back in the 1950s. It was the mid-1950s that this story was published. And it essentially describes this seance that was conducted at, I think it was 10, 15,000 feet above New York. Late
that's
at night.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And allegedly, according to the story, they made contact with a group of scientists and aviators that are on the other side that were working very hard to facilitate this communication to come through. But of course, like all seances, nothing really comes through. Like a lot of, you know, information, but it's a lot of gobbledygook at the same time. And ultimately, though, I found a little bit of a verification that kind of backs up that maybe some of the information that came through might have been true. They may have been talking with something on the other side.
Okay. Well, let's get to that later in the show. I'm looking forward to telling you this story from Lightbringers of the North. I want to tell you the story of the hand in the spring. And the authors start writing about this bus route you can take from Helsinki. It's the number 75. And the last stop is this industrial area. And it's full of all these Finnish names I'm just going to slaughter. But I think it's called Tataruso. It's a typical industrial landscape, they say. Rusty chain link fences, drab buildings, so nothing too exciting. But if you
freezing,
yeah, if you wander through this swampy thicket on the way to the airport, you might run across this little spring that's there. And they say it's partly buried under the highway to another city, but it's still there. And this spring is the same spring that back in August the 19th of 1930. A 14-year-old schoolboy named Leo Loffman found a severed human hand in the spring.
Oh.
There's a photo of it in the book. It's just sitting on this rock in the spring. And according to police investigators, this hand was from the right arm of a woman who had clearly taken good care of her nails, like it was a well-manicured hand. And it caused astonishment. It was this huge story. But since nobody was missing a hand, the case quickly became buried, like nothing ever really came of it. And an entire year goes by. So you come to September the 18th, 1931, and there's this journalist, a reporter, a 23-year-old guy. His name's Armas Kauhanen, and he reports for this national paper, the Helsinki Dispatch. And he's sitting at his office desk and he's just daydreaming because there's not much happening in Helsinki that day. He's daydreaming about getting a big story. And he's very competitive with the other competitor papers of getting the big story. And then the telephone rings and the voice on the other end says, hi, this is a driver from Malmi speaking, like a taxi driver. As I was bending down to get a drink from the spring in Tataruso, there was a thumb floating in there. I haven't even called the police yet, just thought you might want the story. So this reporter, Kahanen, he jumps up. He's like, oh my God, a story. He quickly goes down to the scene and he sees the assistant rural police chief there just drawing body part after body part out of this spring. They found 8 hands, 9 legs, a woman's head, 12 fingers, and a bunch of human hair.
Was it a sacrifice of some kind?
No one knew. What the hell is going on? And based on the state of decomposition, it looked like they'd only recently been put in the spring.
Mm.
So this is the crime story of the century, this young reporter thinks. And he actually sees a rival reporter from one of the other newspapers like hiding in the bushes taking notes. And so they make eye contact. They see each other and this understanding emerges that whoever breaks this story is going to be breaking the biggest story of the year. So they both literally start sprinting back to their offices, like racing against each other, get back to their offices, quickly type up the story, and they run it over to the composing room. And it turned out that Kahanen, the 23-year-old, he got the story out first. The entire print run of their newspaper completely sold out. There wasn't a copy left in the entire city or even in their own offices.
Well, it's a huge story. I mean, something like that attracts a lot of attention.
It completely shocked the nation.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why it was so shocking, because it was right on the heels of this German serial killer. His name was Peter Curtin. He had been sentenced for a multitude of murders and assaults against young women in Dusseldorf in July.
So it was, Germany?
Yeah, in Germany. It was still in people's minds. And the victims, well, they called them the victims of the vampire of Dusseldorf. It was a very sensational story. The Finnish Social Democrat newspaper suspected that a similar case was unfolding in Helsinki. It's like someone's a copycat murderer or it's the same kind of psychopath that's doing this. And the police made a statement that this Tataruso case could be the impulsive whim of a mentally ill person, a psychopath, or someone whose emotional and especially ethical life had become completely numb. So this secluded spring in this industrial area, over the fall, that fall, it became Finland's number one tourist destination.
Wow.
People were traveling from all over Scandinavia to go and see this little spring. Now, this professor of anatomy, Vino Lasilla, he examines the body parts they pulled out of the spring and came to the conclusion that they'd been removed from the corpses of people who had already been dead for some time. So there were no missing people, there were no murders, and based on the poor state of the teeth, he also concluded that they were probably working class, roughly in their 50s. This is the head that they pulled out, the woman's head. So this information brought a twist to the whole situation.
Yeah, I mean, body parts being thrown away from a morgue or...
Yeah, someone's mutilating dead bodies. So where are the corpses coming from? Well, the Helsinki Capital Journal newspaper suspected that someone had cut up the bodies in order to sell them for medical purposes.
That would make sense.
Right? You're selling them to students, medical students, for example. There was an interview that appeared in another paper, the UC Suomi. A professor, Fabritius, the senior physician at one of the local hospitals, speculated that the body parts found may have been dug up from the section of the Malmi cemetery where the paupers were buried, so that, you know, the poor folks, all the homeless. But there were other theories. In addition to medical students, the gypsies were also considered suspects in the violation of graves since they had camped in the area.
But gypsies aren't normally inclined to digging up bodies, are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a university lecturer in philology, Magnus Hammerström. He explained that gypsies would remove the body parts of their dead relatives and plunge them in running water to prevent the dead from coming back to haunt the living. And then this whole zeitgeist got expanded even more. There was this pulp writer, Arne Hapakoski, who wrote his first novel called The Riddle of the Gypsy Swamp and released it just after this story came out where everyone was blaming the gypsies, right? So he releases this in late 1931. The book is about this underground secret society called the KCC Club that's made up of Italian fascists and leading figures from the Soviet Communist Party that aims to breed invincible superhumans from its secret lodge initiates through the practice of occult cannibalism.
And I thought today's conspiracy theories are out there, but that's a new one.
I want to track that book down. So the poor gypsies, like everyone's blaming the gypsies.
Well, they do throw babies at people, so, you know.
So the gypsies were actually interviewed. There was a kind of leader of the Roma community who was interviewed by the Helsingin Sanomat newspaper, and he defended his community. He said, look, we're gypsies. We'll readily steal a pile of hay or deceive someone in a horse trade, but we do not commit a heinous crime like this. And I love the gypsy defense. Like, we're criminals, but we're not those kinds of criminals. That's their defense.
Look, fair enough.
But still, I mean, the churches around Helsinki, they unanimously stated that no one had dug up any bodies. There was no bodies missing from their graveyards. So where else would you get a corpse if not from a graveyard or, you know, like a university's anatomy department?
A hospital.
Well, the local morgue was investigated.
Yeah.
They discovered at the local morgue, corpses, this is the process, corpses are washed, put into boxes. They're loaded onto a corpse train. It runs on Wednesdays and Sundays and basically brings the dead to Malmi Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to police, the corpse mutilations could have taken place either in the Haju morgue, which is where it was. They could have taken place on the train or in the mortuary or graves at the actual cemetery. So a technical investigation was done. They ruled out the train and the mortuary, which left only the graves and the morgue as possibilities. But all fingers started to point to the Haju morgue, because this is where it gets weird. According to witnesses who live nearby, the morgue had been repeatedly visited at night in the summer of 1931 by men wearing well-to-do black suits. The observers had testified that these gentlemen arrived by automobile at midnight and were received by the janitor of the morgue. So we've got men in black.
Yeah, it sounds very men in black.
Arriving in cars in the middle of the night. And when these strange men left a few hours later, they always had heavy packages which the janitor helped in carrying out to their vehicles. The newspaper reported that the horrified eyewitnesses also saw strange green and red lights flashing from the windows of the morgue at night.
Green and red lights?
What is going on? Now, the janitor who's letting these men in black in, he's now prime suspect.
Mm.
He's this 53-year-old guy. His name's Johann Elias Sarenheimo. He's a former carpenter, and he's a member of the Rusuristi.
Who's that?
The Rusuristi is this occult society that broke off from what's like a spin-off of Theosophy in Finland.
Okay.
And chapter one of this book, Lightbringers of the North, is all about the founder and his life story and, you know, how he came across Theosophy.
We should probably cover that, because did they end up going to war? Like, why did they?
There's so much weird stuff in this book. Like, I was skipping ahead to some of the later chapters and going, oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. but, you know, this story I had to focus on because who's behind this? Where are these body parts coming from? So the Helsingin Sanomat newspaper reported that a police search of this morgue janitor's home turned up photographs of corpses and strange quasi-religious literature. So in his home, he had the Musta Ramatu, a.k.a. the Black Bible, a.k.a. the sixth and seventh books of Moses. He also had a booklet on the water healing method. He had this occult Bible. Oh, and how to heal people with water and melatonin suppositories. the method is based on this water healing. It's all based on the writings of this British mystic, Joanna Southcott, who we've mentioned on the show a bunch of times before. She made use of a linen cloth blessed by the society leader, Octavia Baltrop, that was believed to have healing powers. So basically what they did is they'd get a small patch of cloth and their cult leader would pray over it, imbue it with energy, and then you could order it by mail from England. Like, you could just order it.
Oh, so it's like ordering your bathwater.
Yeah, and they would send you the cloth and then you'd put it in your own bottle of water, which would transfer the healing powers from the cloth.
So what we're just talking about.
It's what I was talking about on the last show. The energy is infused into the cloth. You drink the water and you get healed by the prayer energy. The method was introduced by Pekka Ervast, who was the same guy who created this Rusuristi theosophy spin-off in Finland. According to him, the cloth worked flawlessly, even though the first time he got it sent from England, he had a heart attack when he opened the package.
That's just too much prayer energy. You can't handle that.
It's too much, yeah. So the most terrifying thing found, obviously, was the Black Bible, the sixth and seventh books of Moses. So it said these were texts that were left out of the Bible because they contained Kabbalistic spells for really dangerous things like evoking spirits and finding lost treasure.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Summoning spirits is always one to avoid.
It's like a grimoire.
Mm.
The book was originally published in 1849 by the Library Books of Magic, Mystery and Revelation by a Stuttgart antiquarian. But it's got a really sinister reputation in Finland. As late as 1985, librarians in the country were demanding it be removed from libraries because young people were doing devil worship through this old text.
Yeah.
And even in 1929, Pekka Ervast, that guy that created that Rusuristi society, warned his followers about it. He said that a Finnish citizen came to him for help because he was in deep trouble. And it turned out he had taken this black Bible, the Musta Raamattu, and attempted to evoke spirits and get them under his control. And it turned out he saw something so terrifying he couldn't even speak about it. So Ervast said the result that he was unable to get free of these spirits. They were basically haunting him, hounding him, attached to him, followed him home. He couldn't sleep. He found no peace at all. He had incredible insomnia and he didn't know what to do. And so Ervast basically said, so what exactly were your intentions with invoking these spirits? And this guy was like, I wanted to help people and feed the poor and help, you know, give blankets to the homeless. He's like, no. What did you really want to do? And he eventually admitted he wanted to find treasure. He wanted to get rich.
Right,
he wanted gold. But then he added, if I got gold, I could have given that to poor people.
Yes, right, okay. So the spiritual equivalent of what steal from the rich and give to the poor.
And Ervast is like, yeah, okay, sure, buddy. So despite all this, like they find all this in the morgue janitor's home, there's absolutely no evidence at all that he's guilty of butchering these corpses. There's no evidence at all that connects him to it. But finding that black Bible in the occult literature, it's not a good look.
No.
And in the eyes of the public, he's the bad guy. So there's this thirst for the public to, you know, find whoever did the deed, find the perpetrator. So the press starts to deliver to the public what they want.
Yep.
There's all these hit pieces that come out. On October the 8th, there's a headline in the newspaper asking, "What is inside the coffin of the janitor's mother?" So,
implying what?
Well, the article had an interview with a friend of the family. So it's like,
it's always,
here we're interviewing someone who's familiar with the thinking of the janitor. No, this friend of the family who revealed that this guy's mother had been buried the previous winter and that the pallbearers were struggling with the coffin because it was so heavy. And when she died, she was a very thin and frail woman. So why was his mother's coffin so heavy? And the article actually speculated that he was putting mutilated body parts into his mother's coffin to get rid of them. Can you imagine the lawsuit today?
So
there's no evidence of this. This newspaper just rolls out these hit pieces. Another article that came out reported that he had recently covered the windows of his apartment with plywood to prevent a draft in his home. But the newspaper said he most likely did this so that he could practice his mystical nocturnal rites undisturbed.
Of course.
They also said if this janitor, Saren Haimo, did not turn out to be guilty, his family still wanted to get rid of him. They said, quote, a place has been reserved for him at the local mental hospital, so he will remain under observation regardless. So with respect to the secret society that was rumoured to have met with the guy, they had all these speculations about them. Who were these strange men in black suits turning up late at night? They speculated the group was led by someone of higher intellectual and social standing than the janitor. The janitor merely functioned as an obedient servant who got the opportunity to mutilate the bodies. So there's still this finger pointing at some kind of secret society operating in the shadows. Now, there's so much accusation. The police arrest Saren Haimo, and he's arrested in the first week of October. This is 3 days after his arrest, the right-wing Helsinki paper Arjen Sana ran a headline saying the mystery of Tartarisso is going to be solved. Does the trail lead to a sausage factory?
No, they're not eating them. No.
This article alleges that the janitor had regularly visited a certain sausage and head cheese factory. And the newspaper hinted that, you're right, Aaron, the body parts had ended up in the sausages. I love it. Imagine being alive with this story.
I know.
It's literally because there's nothing else happening in Helsinki.
Yeah, because it's too cold.
Like, the news would just normally say, today's snow.
Yeah. Tomorrow,
a reindeer. Snow. Tomorrow's snow. Next week's snow. Essentially,
Northern Light occasionally.
Yeah. The sausage factory ended up suing the newspaper and successfully won the case. Mm. But there was a new saying that had already entered the Finnish language called Tartarissan Salasus, like the secret of the
sausage.
Yeah, it's basically the secret of the sausages. So the company was forever slandered as.
Oh, that's awful.
And imagine the psychology of people, like whenever you're eating those sausages.
Yeah, it'd be in your head. It would be in your head.
Yeah, thinking about eating grandma's dead body.
Yeah.
So if he wasn't responsible, though, because Saren Haimo later demanded damages from the state and he eventually took the state to court and won. But unfortunately for him, the judgment was overturned by the Supreme Court in the country.
Why?
Doesn't say.
Mm.
In the spring of 1932, the entire Saren Haimo family changed their surname. He moved to another city. It basically destroyed the guy's life.
Yeah.
And the life of his relatives as well. But if he wasn't responsible, then who was? Because the mystery of these body parts showing up in that spring hadn't been solved. Several secret societies in Finland started to come under scrutiny. Members of the Order of the Oddfellows, the Rusuristi, the Freemasons, all became suspects in the case. The Minister of the Interior, von Born, appointed Axel Lindström as the head of the Department of Police Detectives to lead the investigation and eventually get to the bottom of it. Von Born also set up a scientific commission consisting of experts in the fields of medicine, psychology, folklore, superstition to study the case. The Finnish government was really serious about solving it. They just threw all these resources at it, and the public demanded to know what was going on. So the irony of this Von Born guy leading it all is that he was a Freemason and was a member of Rusuristi. He was in these occult societies. This eventually came to light because a Lieutenant Colonel Paavo Susitavel came out and accused him publicly. He claimed that Von Born was assigned to the investigation to basically control the investigation, to make the investigation fail.
Oh, yep. So conspiracy theories.
Because he was one of these secret men in black going and doing occult things late at night. And it was true. I mean, von Born was in Russaristi. And it's funny, Russaristi, again, which was the spin-off of Theosophy in Finland, it was founded by this guy, Pekka Avast. Remember the prominent figures in Theosophy we've covered on the show before, like
Ledbetter.
Ledbetter, right? Ledbetter was accused of sodomy with young boys.
Yeah.
Guess who else was accused of sodomy with young boys?
Yeah.
This Finnish guy, Pekka Avast. He was accused of engaging in sodomy with a servant boy. The star witness in this was his gardener, apparently, who overheard the young boy come out of the room in an agitated state, his hair all tousled, and wondering aloud, is this what love is all about?
Oh.
So it's like, what is it with Theosophy?
I don't know.
And Theosophy spin-offs. It's like the true path to higher spirituality is through a young boy.
I'll just never forget the day that we walked into the Theosophy library. They were all lovely there in Sydney. And we walked in and you were like, so what do you think about Ledbetter? And it was like the response was,
we don't talk about Ledbetter. And we were just so upfront about it. So what's this talk of Ledbetter having sex with all these young boys? They nearly had a heart attack, these poor old bitties, because it's their entire life. We're just like, is this guy raping young boys?
That one woman was particularly disturbed.
Yeah, she was like, who are these young men? Send them away. No one believed the claims, though, and this Susi Taival, who was making all these accusations, he was eventually sentenced to prison for defaming von Born. But you could also see, well, who's pulling the power strings in Finland?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
these hidden groups.
Was he exposing too much of the truth? Anyway, after all these investigations went nowhere, some still believe that the poor janitor was the culprit. Remember the British occult historian Montague Summers wrote that famous book, Witchcraft and Black Magic, years ago. In the book, Summers claimed that a membership card of an English occult society was actually found in one of the books at the janitor's home.
Why would they have membership cards?
Hidden inside. Oh, they all had membership cards, like a secret membership card, but it's a membership card. Like there's a secret compartment in your wallet. It's tucked behind your pocket watch.
Yes.
So the discovery of this card led the Finnish police to appeal for help to Scotland Yard. They went straight to Scotland Yard in the UK, and they wanted to locate a nationalized Englishman living in London who was suspected of satanic ritual murders and was associated with this cult in Finland. But who was this mysterious character?
Yes.
Oh.
Who could it be? Who could it be? Is it who I think it is? Yeah.
Oh. It's Aleister Crowley.
Oh.
Could it be the great beast himself? Could he be responsible for the mutilated bodies in Finland?
Absolutely he could be.
It was just a prank, my boy.
Yes, it just all went wrong.
A foreign correspondent for the British newspaper Daily Express, D. Sefton Delmer, he wrote a lead story about this whole thing. He claimed that the crimes had been committed by a quasi-pagan sect of devil worshippers led by a witch. According to Delmer, people in high positions in the cult were deliberately obstructing the police investigation. He claimed that Tattarisso was a bewitched place, having been a site of cult worship for forest spirits in ancient times. And the authors of this book say he was pretty close to the truth.
So what, there was being some, like a sacrifice being made at this ancient site?
Yeah. Well, in early 1932, there was all sorts of strife in Helsinki. There was an attempted government coup. The Tattarisso case started to fade from view. But the police did keep investigating and, you know, they did it quietly, but they never gave up. And the focus had now shifted from the janitor at the morgue to the paupers section of Malmi Cemetery. And this was, remember, Professor Fabritius, the expert had suggested that's where the bodies could have been sourced from.
Mm.
Now, in the paupers section of this cemetery, the poor were buried atop of one another in rows of unmarked graves.
Yep.
Right? They couldn't afford headstones, so they just put in these graves. First, four coffins were laid at the bottom of the grave pit, covered with a thin layer of soil. Then they'd get another four coffins, put them on top and cover them with a thin layer of soil. So, for example, if eight coffins weren't ready for burial all at once, the initial coffins would just be sitting in the pit and they might remain there for a few days before they got some more bodies to bury.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone wanted to get to those coffins, they wouldn't really even need to dig.
No, it's all there.
The coffins are just lying there.
Yeah.
So the police took this into consideration and started to excavate some of those paupers' coffins.
They really think that grave robbing is occurring?
They found 19 mutilated bodies. Hands missing, joints, legs missing, heads missing. A professor of anatomy was brought in. He proved that the body parts found at the spring were from other bodies as well. So that meant in total at least 30 dead bodies had been mutilated from this cemetery. So the poor janitor, he was never involved at all.
Like, yeah.
It was just a complete misdirection. The reporter, Kauhanen, the young guy who broke the story, he was determined to unravel this mystery. So he
because
got...
it's extremely odd. Like, it's beyond odd.
Well, he got word from a source to go and find this little dilapidated house at number 7 Joseph Natinktu Street in Helsinki. Go to this weird house and go and knock on the door because apparently there's a fortune teller there who uses a crystal ball and coffee grounds to get information from the other side.
Oh, yeah, I've heard this kind of stuff.
And he was told she might be able to help you with the case of the mutilated body parts. So he's like, okay, could be a story here. So he tracks down this house. He knocks on the door. No answer. And he actually just waits there for several minutes. He keeps knocking. Finally, this huge overweight woman answers the door. And behind her, there's two grim-looking men sitting in this small room. So the reporter, he introduces himself and he asks this woman if he could consult the coffee grounds in order to find out more about how the Tatarisua mutilations had taken place. She just looks at him and says, come back at midnight, and slams the door in front of him.
Okay.
Now, Kauhanen never went back to the house because he got a weird vibe from the place. Like, it felt dangerous. The men looked, you know, surly, and she was kind of weird.
Also, going to what appears to be a clairvoyant at midnight is not a normal thing either.
Yeah. So for the next few weeks, everything was pretty quiet. And when summer arrived, the reporter was once again sitting at his desk in the editorial department when the secretary brought him a memo from his own publisher. The memo said, "The mystery of Tatarisuo has been solved. Police have arrested several body mutilators who have confessed to their deeds. Missing body parts have been found in the locations they indicated." When he went later to cover the trial of the case, he realized in horror that the accused body mutilators were the same people he went to visit to raid the coffee grounds.
There you go. Yeah, they were probably going to kill him.
It was that woman and those men in that room.
So she was the witch that the rumors...
Okay, so this is where we discover who was behind it all. It was a warlock named Kallio. So the investigation progressed. The police started to pay increasing attention to this guy named Vilho Kallio. He was a driver in Helsinki. He went by the name the Warlock Kallio. He had worked at a quarry near Tatarisuo, and according to eyewitnesses, he had spent the night of Midsummer's Eve in 1930 close to the spring. He was arrested in July of 1932, and he was interrogated on the 11th of August, and that's where the mystery started to unravel because he started to spill. So this guy, 59 years old, and the description of him is that he looks severe. Like, they say he had a sharp gaze of spiritual severity. Very piercing gaze about the guy. He gave off this strange aura. He was the child of a working class mother, had an unknown father. He told interrogators that he'd experienced strong religious visions since childhood, though. So he told them that as a 7-year-old shepherd, he had encountered an unknown man who basically led him into a nearby forest. And he said when he tried to talk to this man, he disappeared in front of his eyes. He said when he was 15 years old, he had followed another unknown woman to a sauna. And then that woman also had mysteriously disappeared in front of his eyes. So there's a history of him seeing spirits, ghosts, perhaps.
Or there's a history of him being psychotic.
Although he had only gone to a small children's school for a few months, he apparently had excellent reading skills. He was able to read the Bible and occult literature. The warlock told interrogators that he rejected the church but believed in the living God. In 1903, he began to ask upstairs whether man had an immortal spirit. So he was praying or asking God. 4 years later, spirits started to visit him in large numbers. Calio said that he had encountered the spirits of the dead, such as a Freemason who was buried in a local cemetery who was annoyed at the knickknacks on his grave. Like people were leaving little mementos.
Right, it's irritating, I get it.
This is all gauche, get rid of it. Callio also said he had washed the sick with special waters. So there's stories of him healing this nine-month-old boy who suffered with a skin condition. And according to him, he would only heal people if their illness wasn't a karmic punishment.
Okay.
He claimed that most illnesses were caused by jealousy or a crime done by the person themselves. It was like some kind of karmic thing. He never charged money. And there's some weird stories associated with his healing. For example, there's a woman named Anne Purinen who said she started to get a strange pain in her foot back in 1921. No doctor was available to cure it. But a family friend brought her to Callio's home because he had this reputation of being able to heal people. What he did was he got a small bag, like a cloth bag, and he just like wiped it all over her head. Then he boiled the bag in some unknown substance and then gave a bottle of it to her. He told her to pour the contents of this vial at a crossroads where three roads met and not to speak to anyone about what she had done, like the actual healing process. And if she did that, she told anyone it wouldn't work. So she does this. She pours this stuff out at the crossroads, like under the full moon or whatever. And to her amazement, her foot is instantly healed, like completely healed. She can run and dance and skip. And it's been this chronic problem for years. But the problem is this woman is a massive gossip.
Right. So can't keep her mouth shut.
She can't help but tell her best friend about this crazy healer that told her to pour the contents of this bottle out at the crossroads. As soon as the words leave her mouth, she's like, oh! Her foot starts killing again. So she goes back to see Calio, the warlock, at his home. And he basically rebukes her and said, you were thoughtless, you were careless, I told you not to tell anyone, there's nothing I can do to help you. And when she was interviewed by the police, she was like, I've had a sore foot for like 12 years now. She's still got it. So one of the other people who sought help from the warlock was this Hilmer Sundberg, who was described as an exceedingly simple woman. She was dependent on the financial help of her parents. She was unemployed. But she'd also been married, but her husband divorced her after growing tired of her erratic mental health. But during the 1920s, Calio had occasionally helped this woman to see things.
Such as?
Well, in the late summer of 1922, he took her to a cemetery to conduct spells from this black Bible. Calio had drawn a magic circle on the ground and he stood inside it with Sundberg and cast a spell. And apparently the spirit of a dead Russian czar appeared to them and started giving them all these demands. So there's a history of him conjuring spirits, but with the aid of maybe a woman that is psychic or has some kind of skills. And then in the summer of 1930, this woman he was with, because he kept working with her and doing seances with her, she started to have a vision of a hand. His hand kept appearing in this vision, a severed hand.
Well, knowing what we know as well, that's not a good sign.
And the spirits she was conversing with through his help started to tell them that they needed to bring the hand to a local spring. And of course, it was that spring in Helsinki. Sundberg later said that Calio had begun to talk in the springtime of that year about a treasure that could be made to rise from the depths of the spring with the help of magic.
Oh, this is why. So it's like greed is driving it.
It all comes back to treasure.
Mm.
So there's this notorious murderer in Finnish history. His name's Hapoja. He was born in 1845 and he hanged himself in prison in 1895. He's known to have committed 3 murders, but the actual number of his victims is said to be more than 20. He's this notorious serial killer. And there was this rumor that he had buried treasure in that spring. That the treasure in that spring was this serial killer's treasure of whatever he had stolen from his victims. And the Black Bible was the key to all of this because the Black Bible contains, as I said earlier, these seals that can be used to find hidden treasure. It even details how to deal with the spirits you conjure, how to command them to find the treasure. Like all the details are in there. So she actually revealed to police the first time they climbed down into an open grave, and she told them how he took this butcher's knife, cut off a hand from one of the corpses, wrapped it in paper cloth, and basically went with her to the spring. And she explained they arrived there at midnight. He dropped the hand into the spring and he said some kind of
incantation,
invocation. Yeah. And then they waited there and waited.
And nothing.
And waited. And eventually she's like, do you ever think maybe it didn't work? And he's like,
we need more hands.
Yeah, we need to stay. We need to stay. So she wanted to leave, but they waited until dawn and returned to city in the morning because no treasure, yeah. Just a dead hand in the spring. Now, they returned to the spring again on Midsummer's Eve, and Sundberg, this woman, said she was horrified because when Kallio arrived, he got on all fours and he started sniffing the ground like a hunting dog. He's like going around in circles.
But looking for what?
Because he wanted to know if anyone else had visited their secret spring.
Oh.
He could sense the scent of anyone else.
It feels just gross and
like
creepy.
He's possessed by a hound or something. An exciting twist to their adventure came when they both claimed they saw this strange old woman dressed in white picking berries. And both Kallio and Sundberg said they saw her at different times, but she eventually vanished. So he became convinced this was one of the guardians of the treasure of the spring.
Spirit.
So the actual mutilation frenzy started the following summer, though. And by this time, that simpleton woman, Sundberg, she was no longer involved, but the magic circle had expanded. On New Year's Eve in 1931, there was this 44-year-old tanner's wife. Her name was Ida Wyden. And she had sought help from the warlock Kallio because she was having a dispute over an inheritance. Now, she became a regular visitor at his apartment. She eventually moved in with him, so there was probably some romantic relationship there. She'd been recently released from prison because she'd forged some documents in regards to this contention over an inheritance. In Kallio's view, this woman, Wyden, had been unjustly sentenced, and he could also see that she had some abilities, right? So
he's probably going to exploit.
The story was he ended up giving her this strange oval object that was cast from lead. It had some weird symbols on it, and he was convinced that if she took it, she would receive messages from the spirit realm. He doesn't explain why he knew this. He just claimed he could tell that she was sensitive. So according to her, this is what she told the police in the interrogations. After she took the object, she saw the walls of the room disappear, the heavens open up, and 2 angels descend and stand either side of this strange gate. This was followed by a vision that was concerning the inheritance dispute. And she said she saw all this like as a motion picture flowing before her eyes. After the vision, Kallio said to her, look, I knew something weird was going to happen, but just go home and try and rest and we'll talk about it later. She goes home, but she can't sleep because she can now see lightning striking across her room. Early the next morning at 6 a.m., she's feeling terrified, she's feeling sick, and she needs to give this object back to the warlock. She's like, this is crazy, I'm seeing all this crazy stuff, I don't know what's going on. She starts to have visions. She starts to see ghosts on the tram that aren't actually there and weird dead people walking through the streets. The visions continue. Whenever she looks on the wall or floor, she sees strange faces and symbols. Like, she's totally losing her mind.
Why does she have to give it back to him, though? Like, why wouldn't she throw it away? The only thing I'm thinking is it's if it's lead, right, if it's cast from lead, lead can cause you to go crazy. Not that fast, but it can cause hallucinations if you get enough of a dose.
Licking it like an ice cream, I don't think.
No.
Yeah, but you're right. It wouldn't be instantaneous. So she goes back to Caligo. She's like, I don't know what's going on. He convinces her to keep it. And while she's at his apartment, she starts seeing writing appear on his apartment walls. And Caligo starts asking her all these questions, like, just benign things like, who's the owner of this building? And in this weird, like, it's almost like a neon glow, it starts writing the answer of the guy's name on the wall, and she can see it.
Which she wouldn't normally know.
And there's no way she would know. She tells him, and he asks, like, what's he doing right now? And it spells out on the wall, he's doing moonshine business, which he was known for, right? And when Caligo asked why another tenant in the building was in arrears for rent and wasn't kicked out, it spelt out on the wall that he was in league with the owner and was helping him with the moonshine business.
Uh-huh.
So all this unknown secret information was coming through the wall, but only she could see it.
But he's clearly using her.
He's using her to get the information. Mm. So they use this to do regular seances. She would go to his apartment and they would sit there and they would ask questions, and it's like using a Ouija board, but they would get it written on the wall for them. And Caligo became enchanted by this star world that started to be unveiled with these questions.
I wonder why he can't access it though. Like, why does he have to use a proxy?
It's just like, remember John Dee? Like, John Dee had to use a medium.
Mm.
Like, all these, like Crowley. Crowley always had to use a medium, had to use someone with abilities. It's like all these warlocks and wizards, they need an instrument to wield, and the instrument is a sensitive person. Wyden, this woman, she apparently went on all these astral journeys as well. She saw people, cities, landscapes, and then she would write down all these notes. She claimed that there was a hidden spiritual ruler of every country, and that the ruler of Finland was this little old woman who just like ruled from the spirit world. And then things started to get really weird, because in 1931, instead of just messages about the astral world appearing on the wall and in her visions, the wall started to tell them to get severed hands. The wall started to tell them that they needed severed heads and legs. And they ended up being told by the wall that they needed to find the sequel to the Bible, which was like...
Is that the treasure?
Which was the Black Bible, right? So Wyden said that in her visions, she'd seen all the misdeeds of the human race, that she'd seen the full wrath of God firsthand, and that her mission, as dictated by the writing on this wall, was to purify the human race and to vanquish all injustice.
So good luck with that.
Again, it's like, we're going to create this utopia.
Yeah.
And we're going to get rid of all the evildoers, and we're going to have equity and justice in the world.
Every time with these groups, every time.
The same vision showed her 22 different gods. She remembered some of the names. One was Fenitzar, one was Mikael, and one was Hezegar. And these gods were on a mission to end injustice as well. Like, she was being helped by these sacred gods who wanted to bring equity to the world. So these gods spoke to her through the wall, and one of them proclaimed to her, graves will open and everyone will raise up, because now it is the time of reckoning. It is the time of anguish and trouble. Woe to those who are crushed by my hand, but happiness to those who remain.
So kind of like a rapture in a way?
Yeah, it's like you're either on my side or you're against me. Wyden urged the warlock Caligo to return to the paupers' graves at Malmi Cemetery and acquire more body parts, and then they would perform a ritual. So
But the use of severed body parts to promote equity, I mean, it just kind of underpins the hypocrisy of, you know, that idea of bringing about a utopia, doesn't it?
Like, yeah, it's a horrible, complete madness.
Yeah.
Again, it's just like you mentioned on the last show, where these spirits drive people insane. Mm. They get them to do these crazy evil things.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. They're trying to see just how crazy they can get human beings to be.
And apparently these gods were also at war with the Freemasons and the Theosophists, and that if they got these body parts and put them in the spring, it would also help Wyden with her inheritance case, because she now believed that the only reason she lost was because the Freemasons and the Theosophists were wheeling and dealing behind the scenes. So the magic circle expands now. Four people went to perform the ritual at the spring on May 25th, 1931. You had the warlock Callio, the psychic woman Wyden. You had Johann Hedman, who was Wyden's 20-year-old son. And the fourth member was Hilda Freeman, this cleaning lady from the local school. I like that they just get this cleaning
bring
lady.
At random.
So, oh, come, no worries. So Callio, kneeling in front of the dark water, he placed a tiny piece of paper in front of him. And according to the eyewitnesses who were interrogated separately by the police, they all claim a huge group of spirits appeared and one of them claimed to be that serial killer, that famous Finnish serial killer, right? Whose treasure is supposedly in here.
Mm.
According to Wyden, the spirit manifested next to the spring and politely pointed to where the treasure was, telling her the magic incantation that would make it surface, which was, "My father's sister knows nothing. I walk away quietly." That's the secret words. You say that.
See, I know that obviously any incantation could be anything, but you'd expect it to be a little bit more exotic than that.
Like
Namas Reime Rada.
Throw some Latin in there.
Yeah, something.
Least. So the spirit then disappears. So Callio, he repeats the magic words, "My father's sister knows nothing. I walk away quietly." And they all watch as the spring starts bubbling, this weird bubbling, like it's boiling, and something starts rising to the surface. It's this huge coffer, right? This huge coffer, and it pops open. And they can all see inside, like, there's this huge silver pot. There's a bottle filled with gold coins. It's just brimming with treasure. And Callio reaches out to try and touch it, and it goes, boom, slams shut. Yep,
it feels like a trap.
Starts sinking back to the depths of the spring. Now, Wyden then receives a vision of a wonderful garden filled with black entities. And from somewhere, the light entities had arrived, and this beautiful singing that's purifying the place. And Callio can hear all this as well. And they both get the message that says, "Lord Fenitzar will rule for 1,000 years. So they're now told that in order to get the treasure, they have to enable the rule of Lord Fenitzar, and they need to hurry back home before light strikes so that they can do another ritual. So they all rush back to Callio's apartment, all four of them. And as soon as they get home, there's all this weird knocking, like poltergeist, knock, 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 going all around the apartment. And this voice coming from nowhere saying, "The new Jehovah is coming. Brace yourself for Lord Fenitzar. He will rule for 1,000 years. And then knock, 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 knock. They also received a message that it was now forbidden for them to go to more graves because God didn't need any more bones.
Okay.
Now another character arrives. You got to go back to 1930, where Wyden, this woman, she had a really strange vision where she saw this narrow-faced man with curly hair had appeared in her wall at home. Like, he actually almost emerged from the wall. And the voice, the words on the wall told her that this man is the devil. When you see him, capture him.
How is she supposed to capture him?
Well, she's got her other guys with her. She's got this magical circle now. That same autumn, a man appears at Hilda Fridman's name day celebration. It's the man whose face she saw on the wall. His name's Vil Saari. It's the exact spitting image of that face she saw. So Carlio and Wyden, they conduct an occult investigation and they come to the conclusion that this guy, Val Sari, is actually Lucifer and he's on a mission to bring evil into the world. Sari himself, they confront him with this and he's like, well, I'm actually conqueror and lord of the world, so you're not far off. Like, he actually agrees with them. And he says to them, we need to go to the Malmi Cemetery and we need to get some hands. We need to sever some hands.
And they go along with this?
Yeah, so they're scared of him because they actually think he's Lucifer, but they also want to use his power. So they all go again to the bloody cemetery and they start to get more hands. Now, when they're at the cemetery, Carlio convinces this new guy, Sari, that his powers need to be transferred to him. Like, Carlio needs to get Sari's powers. And that when that happens through this occult ritual, Sari will receive the powers of the prophet Elijah, and then he'll be able to defeat injustice in the world and he won't follow his dark Lucifer path anymore.
Sure. Yeah, because that's how it always works out.
And you just thought this was a simple story about finding some dead guy's hand in a spring.
I really did. I thought this was going to be some type of sick serial killer or just some weird pervert.
So they go to this Malmi cemetery and they do this ritual. Carlio and this evil Satan Sari's there and Wyden as well. And they start uttering these strange words. Like, Carlio says, on a trail of truth blazed by Lord Fentazar across the world where many suffer from injustice, thou shalt not stand in the way of your ancestors. And he goes on and on about equity, blah, 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 ending all injustice. Sari in turn responds saying, I, the Lord and Creator, the Alpha and Omega, blah, 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 Son of Man, blah, 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 fulfilling the Bible.
Jeez, it really appeals to these narcissistic virtue-signaling saviors of the world,
but
doesn't it?
Wyden watches as this strange kind of comes out of this Sari guy and transfers to Carlio. And it seems as like it worked and Carlio now has all this power. But sometime after this transference ritual, and remember, this is all in the police records, like they were just telling all this. Sari had reportedly gone for a walk after the ceremony because he's dealing with it. He's like, oh, finally, you know, my powers have been freed. They're given to someone else. I'm not the Dark Lord anymore. I'm not Lucifer. Now I can live my life to serve a greater good. But as he was walking around, he saw some secret Freemasons hiding behind some of the headstones.
Secret Freemasons.
This is what he said. Secret Freemasons. They were moving about in a stealthy manner in the graveyard. Now, he realized he still had some spiritual power left. So he immediately launched an occult attack against these stealthy Freemasons. He told the police he shot lightning bolts from his fingers towards them and forced them to run for their lives. So he was like, unlimited, well, I mean, limited power. And a little bzzz came out and he zapped them and they ran away. So this circle now was well underway. You would go out on regular nights. They would take like fingers and legs and heads. And they would take them to this spring and they would just bloop, 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 drop them in the spring because they're trying to now raise this, what's his name again, the Lord and Creator of the world, Fenitzar. And they're also trying to get the treasure to bubble up again so that they can get it.
Isn't it odd, though, in these occult practices, how human body parts become this sacrifice? It's like it appears in other paranormal phenomena as well. It's like blood, this life force, a flesh. It's something feeding on it.
Well, during the interrogations, this Ville Sari guy said they mutilated a total of 51 corpses.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot.
There was all this other stuff they did. Like, apparently, in one session in the apartment, the wall started telling them that they needed to bury a bunch of doves to fight the evil theosophists. And just at that precise moment, 11 doves flew in through the window. And so they killed the doves and went and buried them on a hillside. And the police that are listening to this interrogation are just like, this is bullshit. But then they go to the hillside and they dig up a bunch of dead doves that have been buried in the hillside.
It's all very odd.
Then there was all this infighting. So Sari believed that Carlio and Wyden were trying to take him out now that they'd stole his Lucifer powers. And so he ended up burying a bunch of doves on a hillside to try and stop them as well. And then finally, there's a witch trial. Kalia receives a prison sentence of 2 years and 4 months. Sari, the former Lucifer guy, gets 3 years. And Wyden and her son, Hedman, get probation. And that's it. Now, that might seem like a light sentence, even for Scandinavia. And it is. He says, for that time in history, that's just a moderate degree of punishment. So
does that mean that there was someone hidden in the shadows that was...
Well, they say it's clear that the court didn't consider the group to be fully responsible for their deeds. They were being...
Suggesting that there was someone else or something else.
I don't know. It's not really explained. Does the court just think that they're crazy people and...
But normally they would say that, right? If there was some type of mental defect that had influenced them, that would have been part of it. Like, that would have been announced.
I think the court just thought they were idiots. And they didn't really harm anyone that was alive.
Still, though, mutilating a corpse and...
It's pretty gruesome. But yeah, the most Kalia got was, 2 years and 4 months. And some of the stuff they got up to, like Hedman, who was the son of Wyden, the woman that was seeing everything. Wyden one day said that she'd received a message from the God of the Israelites commanding, remember the school janitor lady that was part of their circle? It's never explained why. Wyden said that she received a message from the God of the Israelites telling the school cleaning lady that she was never, ever able to open any of the school doors ever again.
Well, that's going to be a problem if you're a janitor.
And she was like, but I work at the school. It's much. She had to quit her job. So she ended up quitting her job. She'd worked there for like 20 years. But because this crazy woman of the magic circle said you're not allowed to open any school doors, she had to quit her job. Wyden also said this woman had to destroy all of her family photographs, pawn all her valuables, destroy the receipts, and then sell all of her clothing except for what she was wearing.
For what purpose?
Well, Wyden said once she had done all that, all the money needed to be fairly distributed amongst the magic circle.
Oh, so it's just a massive scam with some occult seasoning on top.
So the ultimate twist to this is that her son, her illegitimate son, Hedman, remember the whole thing with Wyden is that she was in this inheritance dispute, okay? The inheritance dispute was because she had had a relationship with this Dr. Johann Parvianen, and he was mega rich. He had an estate worth like $20 million equivalent to today's money, a huge estate. And the accusation was that her son Hedman was his illegitimate son. Like they had... They basically like a Schwarzenegger moment where he got the maid pregnant.
Right, yeah.
So this guy, Hedman, he claimed that he had documentation proving this, right? And he wasn't really involved with the circle. He kind of got looped into it. And there's an accusation that people that have studied this case later said that he was actually framed. Like a lot of the case was set up to frame him. And one of the key kind of conspiracies around this is that the chief investigator that ended up prosecuting these guys, the Magic Circle, was this guy named Emil Enneberg.
Where does he fit in?
He was this doctor's family lawyer. The guy with the rich estate. Mm-hmm. He was also their lawyer. So it was like he had all this motivation and, you know, hired by the family to make this whole inheritance thing disappear.
Go away.
So once this Hedman guy wrapped up in these charges, he was never going to win any claim to the estate.
Is it, okay, just to extrapolate upon this a little bit, is it possible that they somehow utilized the occult to basically make these guys look like idiots? Like they, like this activity still took place, the phenomenon still occurred, but it was because they used secret occult practices to make them look nuts.
I think all of the above in this case.
Yeah.
I think everything is, everything is true. It's too weird. It's so strange. It's got all the hallmarks of, you know, a spirit messing with people. It's
absolutely
got the whole
does.
Treasure, lost treasure thing. It's got the conspiracy. Who are these strange men in black suits going to the morgue at night?
And the weird sacrifice.
Why is there flashing lights coming out of the morgue? What is going on?
And the cars?
Yeah, it's very bizarre. There's all these bizarre elements to it. I was so happy that I found this in a book about occult Finland. It's like, I never thought you'd find that kind of wild, crazy story. Because I thought it would be all these dusty reports of, well, this
Norgan
guy, Gurdjieff, he was involved in 1912.
No, but some of the weirdest stuff, of especially like contact stuff, comes out of Scandinavia. Like that region of the world. And like I've said, with a lot of this stuff, because it's in foreign languages, like it's kind of hidden.
Yeah.
It's only just slowly being translated and this stuff is seeping out. And we're going, oh my God, the weird stuff that was happening in the US as also like back in the 50s, 60s was also happening all around the world.
Yeah, that's true. And like I said earlier, I think I'll do another story from one of the later chapters as well. There's some really weird destruction of Atlantis and the gates of Hamankainen, like all these weird underwater realms. And there's all sorts of strange stuff in here. It looks really fun. So the book again is Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland.
Well, I'm immensely disappointed.
Why?
That I didn't open up my Kindle to see that the book was there. Because I had it on pre-order and you got to it before I did.
Well, you do the next story then.
All right, we'll see. We'll see how we go. Look, it really was a fantastic book. But I wanted to tell you this story about the flying ghosts and the world's alleged first flying seance. This was written by John Goldstrom back in the 1950s. And John Goldstrom was an aviation journalist, right? And he essentially he was like at the very cutting edge of aviation, pioneering aviation. And he said that there's this story that he'd heard about the time that he published this book about Charles Lindbergh. Now, we've heard this. It was about Charles Lindbergh kind of had a third man effect happen, that he was moving across or flying across the Atlantic on a flight to Paris, the one that made him famous, obviously. And he was exhausted. He was completely exhausted. And something stepped in. Someone stepped in to help him navigate and fly his plane.
That's right.
Across the Atlantic. And, John says this surprised many of us in the aviation field because we'd always regarded him as being a pragmatist. Like he was a pragmatic pilot. He depended mainly upon himself, his instruments, and his map. Like he wouldn't make this stuff up. It was unusual for him to describe this. But Lindbergh never actually identified who his ghostly navigators and helpers were. But believers, apparently, John says, in the aviation field, there was a large swathe of people that believed in psychic phenomena. Now, I wonder why that is. I don't. Maybe it's because like you're already pushing the boundaries of science and, stepping off the earth. And it was because it was believed for so long that humans would never fly. Like maybe you'd be automatically inclined to believe in that kind of stuff. But there were. And there were many aviators in the field that were convinced that the people that helped Lindbergh were actually early instructors and associates that had passed on. And John says, indeed, at the start of the aviation industry and aviation taking flight, we actually had more friends in the spirit world than we did in this life. But he said, then in 1936, I took a flight that completely changed my life. But we have to go back first before we actually get into how he got to this. So being, an aviation journalist, he also dabbled in other things as well. And it just so happened in 1922, he was attending this lecture tour that was being conducted by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. Now, we know that Conan Doyle has had an interest in other parapsychological topics, like the Hounds of Baskerville and black dogs and that kind of stuff. But apparently it wasn't as popular as, obviously, his Sherlock Holmes work. But even so, he had a loyal fan base of people that were fascinated in what he had to say. And, Conan Doyle really had this idea that we could communicate with people on the other side. And so he was there and John ended up going and speaking directly with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and interviewed him for over an hour and spoke to him all about the different ideas about, life after death and communications and how possibly we could communicate with people that have passed over. He got a lot of information out of him, but what's really important is that he spoke to him, as I said, for that hour. So he knew what his voice sounded like. And he ended up having two meetings with him throughout his career. So he knew this guy reasonably well. He could identify what his voice was. But essentially, he says that after I had gone and spoken to him and attended this seance, I was unconvinced. You know, I was fascinated by what he had to say, but I was unconvinced about, you know, spiritualism and, you know, what he was doing. We had a discussion about Oliver Lodge, and Oliver Lodge was interesting in that he actually wrote a book called Raymond, and he wrote this shortly after World War One. And the reason why he wrote it is because he was claiming that he was in frequent communication with his son of the same name who had been killed in said war, right? So this is part of their discussion, which you go, well, why would you include this? Why is this relevant? Well, it becomes very relevant later on because essentially Sir Oliver Lodge was a Nobel Prize winning physicist whose scientific discoveries led to the development of radio.
Right.
All right. So you can see where this is starting to go because apparently with the discussion with when he was sitting down with Conan Doyle, they were talking about radio. And kind of like crossing over to the idea, it's like it was Edison was looking at the idea of developing some type of radio communication with the spirits. And they're just having this kind of off-the-cuff discussion about, you know, extrasensory power and how you can communicate. And it just so happened that they came to the topic of radio. And Conan Doyle was saying, well, look, you know, it's like seances have to be conducted in darkness. And of course, you know, John inquires as to why. He's like, well, why? Like, why does it have to be in darkness? Doesn't that lead to the possibility of there being fraud?
Yeah.
And even Conan Doyle says, well, look, you know, if you have one counterfeit dollar, does that undermine your confidence in the entire US currency? And John goes, okay, that's a good point. He's like, the reason is, from what I understand, is because they can't demonstrate their extraordinary power through daylight. Like, it can happen sometimes, but essentially there's a stronger vibration that allows the spirits to communicate in darkness. There's less interference. It's much like radio reception. Radio reception is stronger at night. And experiments have actually proven that that is the effect. And remember, this is back, you know, 1922, they're sitting there having this discussion. So you can tell that through this ad hoc discussion that they're having, it's building up to something. Like, it's building something else that's kind of, it's like an idea that is blossoming between the two, but we can't see that just yet. So he says, look, it's very interesting. And he says, what about just that idea, you know, like radio reception being, you know, greater at night and seances being dark? And what would happen if someone did a seance on a plane? And Conan Doyle responds and says, oh, yeah, that's quite a good idea. However, the problem is that it would actually be quite contrary to getting the seance to work correctly, because the vibrations and the sound of the aircraft, you know, up so high would actually interfere.
That's true. It would
interfere with the I guess, not only the people that are there trying to, you know, participate in the seance, but also, you know, it would disrupt the medium and it just probably wouldn't work. So, and obviously even back then with aircraft, you know, you had transport planes that weren't well insulated at all. So several years pass, and this is after Conan Doyle's death. It just so happened that a friend of John's was attending this seance. And of course, it was around the time where seances were like a Friday night thing. That's what you did. You went out and you went to a seance. And he said that his friend and her husband, who was a certified public accountant, and I love it when they include, like, this is such an old story, but they include the profession of the person to kind of add to their
validity.
Exactly. So they were attending this seance, and they claim that when they attended this seance, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle came through. And they knew that John had spoken with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle on a couple of occasions and at length, and had said, well, you should come along to the seance next time and see if he comes through and you can tell us if that's the voice. And of course, John says, oh, actually, that would be a bit of fun. I'll go along. And so he does. He goes along to this seance that was conducted by Frank Decker. And Frank Decker was this direct-voiced medium. He had a good reputation among spiritualists. And he goes to this apartment on West 73rd Street near Amsterdam Avenue in New York. And he said he had the opportunity beforehand to actually examine the seance room before it was darkened. He said there was no cabinets. There was no other what appeared to be, you know, apparatuses to conceal the medium or hide things or objects or speakers or anything like that. And he says he sits down and the seance is conducted. And of course, there were 22 people that were in this room when the seance was being conducted. He says it wasn't long after the medium had gone into trance that there were ghostly lights that would be seen around the room. And he says he was insistent. These were not lights that were projected onto the walls. They were floating about the room, like they were in the middle of the room and around the room. You know, and moving towards the ceiling. And then after a few moments of silence, there's the sound of an aeroplane propeller that seemingly comes from everywhere around them in the room. And this voice that says, hello, mother. Now he's sitting there going, where's the propeller coming from and who's this mother? And meanwhile, this old bag sitting next to him is like, oh, son, it's so wonderful to hear your voice. And they start having a full-on conversation. And he's shocked because it's like just two people having a conversation next to him while he's waiting for a train. And later on, after this seance ends, he asks her, like he says, what happened? And this elderly lady, she said, well, that was my son. And my son was an aviator who was killed in a crash. And he frequently comes and communicates with me. It just so happened that he appeared at this seance. Now, skipping back into the seance, there were several manifestations. There were voices that were coming out of the darkness and other people were speaking with passed on loved ones. But it was him. Now, look, there is a possibility that because the friends had invited him and Arthur Conan Doyle had appeared before, that maybe this is some kind of setup. Mm. But John insists that he was taken aback by this because he said, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's voice came through. And he said, I am Conan Doyle and I want to speak to Mr. John Goldstrom. John, where are you? And they start chatting away. Now, this is the interesting thing, right? All the details of the conversation that he had with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle that I told you before, no one knew about it.
Yeah, of course.
They didn't know about the discussion. Like, he hadn't told anyone. And this voice that's coming through, he's like, look, unless they had a phonographer or some type of, you know, like a basically an old, you know, recording device, it's pretty amazing how that this voice sounded like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It was for all he knew, his voice. And he says, do you remember that discussion we had when you wrote that lovely piece on me? And he's like, yes. Well, I think it's time to try that experiment, don't you? And he says, yeah, okay, we can do that. You must go up in the plane and you must conduct your seance. We'll be helping you. And then it ends. The seance ends. So as I said, he's shocked because while he did write an article about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, it didn't include any of those details that I gave you before. None. No one knew about it. So how is it that this spirit had come through? Now, immediately, I like where John goes with this. He's like, well, no, that wasn't Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. That was the medium that was reading my mind. So okay, he's like ready to accept that telepathy exists, but is like
not the perfect reproduction of someone else's voice.
Yeah, exactly. So that can't be what's going on. But he was obviously very intrigued by this and he thought, okay, this is an opportunity to do this. And obviously he has contacts in the industry because of, you know, of who he is and the friends that he has. And so he starts looking around at conducting this airborne seance. And he goes, actually, the other thing that came out of this, though, which was really intriguing, I forgot to mention, was that when this voice of Conan Doyle came through, he actually makes a very specific reference to when they were discussing the plane being too loud, right? Mm. And he says to John, you know that aircraft you flew on recently would be perfect for the seance.
Oh, and he had flown on something recently.
His father had died and he'd flown to Pittsburgh from New York in this modern Douglas transport plane. It was a 14-passenger plane that had recently been insulated against the sound of the engines, reducing it to a low hum on the inside. So completely different, right? Again, another very, very minute but important detail that he was able to pull up. So he said, I left the seance room shaken. Like, not only had I received evidence of survival and communication, but also received an invitation to test the evidence further by an extraordinary means. So he figured, look, the conditions in the aircraft, you know, are a couple of thousand or 10,000 feet above the ground would be vastly more difficult for a medium. So I'm going to need to find essentially a crack team. I need to find a good team of people. So they did. They went around and they tried to, he tried to see who he could get together. And it just so happened that he did. He spoke to Frank Decker, who was the guy that was running the seance. And Frank said, look, I'm unavailable because I've got ill health. But he ends up getting the services of Maynard Tafe. Maynard Tafe was exceptionally well known for her abilities to be a medium. And she was well known because she'd written a book called Station Astral. And what she had done is she'd gone to the Smithsonian Institute without having any knowledge of science whatsoever and had sat there and had set out, you know, scientific phrases and equations and, you know, conveyed information that she simply couldn't have known. Mm. But somehow it was coming through from this other world. So they decide that, yep, we're going to conduct this high altitude seance. So this happened in 1936 in the air over New York. They went and spoke to an airline. And the first airline they spoke to were just like, oh, what do you want this for? Why do you want to charter this Douglas transport? And he's like, oh, we want to conduct a seance. And they were just like, oh, all of our Douglas transports are not working at the moment.
Who would say yes to this?
I know. So eventually, though, through his contacts, he makes contact with another airline who is more than happy to allow him to charter this Douglas transport on the condition that it's completely anonymous and that not even the names of the pilot and the co-pilot are to be mentioned. And he agrees. He's like, okay, that's fine. I've got no issue with that. And you have to remember also, there was a lot of concern about this. You know, Maina Taaffe, she said, look, I don't want to be involved in this if it goes wrong. Like, if it doesn't work, I don't want to subject myself to ridicule. And so they agree and they say, no, if nothing happens of this, we won't, you know, involve you. We won't mention your name. There was also DeWitt McKenzie, who was a London correspondent with the Associated Press. So a journalist, he came along. He'd also spoken with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So he knew what his voice sounded like. Also, DeWitt McKenzie also claimed that Conan's widow, Lady Doyle, had actually claimed to have been in frequent communication with her husband after he died. And there was kind of this little anecdotal story that came out that she had saved the life, well, in fact, he had saved the life of his son through her, because Arthur Conan Doyle's son was a motor car racer, like he was an early motor car racer. And on the day of a race, or on the eve of a race, Lady Conan Doyle received information from her deceased husband that there was something wrong with the car. Now, she took that information and they went and checked and they went, no, there's nothing wrong with the car. Until at the very last moment, they realized that there was a crack in the steering pinion and that had racing, that would have been highly likely to have broken or snapped and would have killed him. So, you know, again, like these little pieces of information that come through. So they end up, getting people on board the aircraft. Now, unfortunately, at the last moment, Hitler had just invaded the Rhine country. So he says, look, I can't go. He sends a reporter in his place. And this cabin with 14 passengers is carefully inspected before the flight to make sure that there was no way that there was any reproduction voice materials or instruments that were on board or apparatuses. And then away they go. There's also a Dr. David Webster, who was a leading Manhattan surgeon. You've also got people who had flown in World War I. You've got contemporaries, obviously psychics, but you've also got a couple of dissenters as well, a couple of people that are not believers in this phenomena, just to add an air of, a control.
Do you have any parachutes?
No, none of that is mentioned, but they take off.
Ask to bring some parachutes.
Well, they take off into the air and everything's going fine. And as they're flying along, it's at one point that he walks up to the pilot and he says, look, can we fly over Floyd Bennett Field? And the pilot says, yeah, sure, not a problem. Not giving him any information as to why. But apparently there'd been a voice that had attended one of these seances, that had shown up at one of these seances, declaring itself to be Floyd Bennett, who had been the first person to fly a plane over the North Pole with the Bird Expedition, and had said that I will speak again as long as you fly over Floyd Bennett Field. So they get going. They start the seance. There's moonlight reflecting off all the silvery wings and the silvery components inside the aircraft. Through the cabin windows, they've reached 8,000 feet, approaching 10,000 feet a little bit later on. The lights are twinkling below. Nothing. There's nothing. But then suddenly this voice speaks, and it comes from the ceiling of the cabin. It wasn't the voice of Conan Doyle, but it was actually Lincoln Beachey. Lincoln Beachey was a pioneering Curtiss exhibition flyer. And straight away, what he says to John is like, it's a hell of a lot different than flying in those old pushers, isn't it, John? And John is fascinated because what it was, like the pushers used to be, first of all, unfortunately, Lincoln Beachey had died in this aircraft that had crashed laden with fireworks in San Francisco Bay. It was all like, he was obviously doing exhibition work. But the aircraft that they used, the propeller was at the back, so it would push the aircraft.
Oh,
so that's why they were called pushers.
Yep.
And it just so happened that in 1910, John had agreed to fly one of these things. So, I mean, again, information that may have been out there, but difficult for people to know that, you know, for this, so it was a little bit of a validation coming through. Then this light flashed in the face of Dr. Webster. Now, Dr. Webster, this renowned surgeon, suddenly says, oh, that will be my son, David. And John says, well, what do you mean? He's like, oh, he always comes to me this way. He just sometimes appears. And then his wife, who was with him, they just start talking to this light where their son is somehow communicating with them through this seance. But guess what? Dr. Webster's son had been an aviator and had died in a plane crash in Vienna. Again, these pioneering aviators that are coming through. Now, Silence descends upon the place once again. And then if they finally get over Floyd Bennett Field, the moment they are over Floyd Bennett Field, a voice says, "This is Floyd Bennett." And they start talking. Now, Floyd Bennett suggests that he has friends on the other side that are working on their side to allow the communication to take place. Well, Floyd Bennett, right? Floyd Bennett had, when he'd flown, he'd worked with a group of men who had developed instruments to allow them to navigate and to fly over the North Pole. They had obviously passed away, and they had taken this knowledge with them into the other side,
right,
and were using their engineering capabilities to work on these instruments to allow communication with the other side, which being our side. Isn't that weird? It's like they still have to use technology and
take their expertise and figure out how to make contact.
Yeah. So they start, you know, he gets this impression, or he's told that, well, look, others will come to speak to you this evening. It's very Dickens, you know, it's in that kind of way. And, you know, he's like, oh, okay, you know, and the flight continues. And they claim, John claims, and this is of other people in the flight as well, they can see these ectoplasmic forms that start materializing around them in the half light of the cabin. Like, they've only got the light of the city beneath them kind of coming up into the cabin. And they can see them. Like, they can see them and they can feel their presence, but they're not capable of materializing fully into this world. Like, they just can't materialize fully. And as this is continuing to go along, Conan Doyle appears. And Arthur Conan Doyle says, "Oh, yes, this is Arthur Conan Doyle. I wanted to thank you, John Goldstrom, for appearing to me and doing this. How remarkable should it be that you are flying tonight to the air and my earthly body lies more than 3,000 miles across the Atlantic Ocean in England?" Like, just incredible stuff, right? So they start, you know, discussing about the seance, and you know, more information comes through about how, you know, the details that of the discussion that they'd had and how they're working from the other side. Apparently, though, it's quite difficult, right? Conan Doyle insists that they're actually working on the other side, trying to stop the Second World War, because they questioned during the seance to say, well, look, could World War II actually be possibly averted? And he says, well, we are working. We are working hard here to prevent a catastrophe, but at the moment, it seems like it's doubtful. We probably won't be able to do that. God bless you all and good night. And then he's gone, right? So there's this group that not only working to allow communication during seances from the other side, apparently they were working to stop Hitler and the start of the Second World War. But then,
how, with their spooky voices at night?
Well, who knows what they're doing? Yeah, exactly. I mean, but although there are stories of Hitler, you know, claiming that entities would appear to him as well. So, I mean, maybe this is part of it. But you would think that this is over. No, it's not. The next guy that appears is Raoul Amundsen, who was the discoverer of the South Pole. His plane had gone down some years earlier in the Arctic when it had crashed into fog-bound icebergs. And at the time, there's two really important things that stick out here, is that he had known Admiral Byrd, right? And Admiral Byrd had this terrible incident that took place. Now, we find out from the seance, right? So this information is not known on the aircraft. Like, they don't know. But there's two things. First of all, Raoul says to them, look, we will find my aircraft. It will wash up on the north coast of Norway. But that's not important right now, because at the moment, at that time, the aircraft hadn't been found. It was still missing. He says, I have to tell you about Admiral Byrd. I can see there are fumes around him, and he's being asphyxiated. And I have pulled him aside and cleared the air, and now he'll be okay. Now, years later, Admiral Byrd wrote his version of these events, not known in the aircraft at the time. Admiral Byrd had been near a small stove when he was, I think he was camping or something, and the stove had caused a release of gas. And something, he'd started to pass out, something had grabbed him and pulled him away and thrown him out into the cold air, allowing this rush of fresh air to come through. Well, at the same time, you've got the spirit coming through on an aircraft telling them that they had just saved him. So it's like this weird third man effect, but the third man is actually a dead aviator who's now communicating through a seance. Now, following this, after the seance had been completed, the aircraft is found. It's found on a beach in northern Norway. They couldn't have known that. Like, it's found a few days later.
Oh, wow.
So again, like, more validation and more information coming through.
Did Amelia Earhart come through?
No, she didn't. No, but then, you know, after all this had taken place and they get this, you know, crazy validation, You know, he feels a whack on his shoulder blade, although there was no visible hand that had thumped him, but he can feel it because he's told by these spirits that he essentially has made history tonight. The last voice that allegedly comes through is that of Thomas Edison. And Thomas Edison starts talking about how at the very end of his life, he had almost created instruments to allow the communication with spirits. And he wanted to congratulate them on achieving the success utilizing this aircraft. Now, the aircraft landed and that was the end of it. Like, this became known as the flying seance and it kind of just disappeared into history.
I thought this was going to be an aircraft disaster story. I wanted to hear about something going wrong, smoke filling the cabin. They had to find the black box.
No, nothing like that.
They could have all just done that on the ground.
Well, no, because apparently the whole point of this was, the reason why they had to conduct it in the air was because it allows greater access to those spirits that are working on the other side. To be up in the air. Which, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's the early times of spiritualism that it's like, it's that idea that, well, look, heaven is an actual place and it's up there, so if you're up higher to it, maybe the signal is stronger. But I think it was more than that. Like, from, it was the time of, you know, pioneering understanding of not only aviation, but radio as well. You know, and he makes this point. He says, well, he's like, John was shocked by this entire experience, especially the validations that he had following this as well, of information that he couldn't possibly have known, but it came through to him during the seance. The voices sounded, at least with Arthur Conan Doyle, sounded like the person he had spoken to. There were different people on the flight. You know, how is it that this voice could have been replicated so well? But ultimately, he kind of ends with this quote and says, well, look, you know, science is still trying to understand, you know, what this is. And you can see that there's a very much a hopeful attitude about him, but obviously it's, you know, it's become very different today. But he was quite hopeful that a science would essentially back this up.
If only science could discover it.
But he makes this point, like he says, well, the bumblebee, I can't remember who quoted this, but he says the bumblebee is Orville Wright. The bumblebee is totally, you know, aerodynamically incapable of flying. Like, it's not designed, its wings are not aerodynamically big enough to support its volume, right? But the bumblebee doesn't know that, and it flies. And he's like, this is a kind of a metaphor for him with the seance.
That could be true of anything. You're not aerodynamically fit to fly, but if you believed, you could jump on the top of this warehouse, and if you fully believed.
I identify as a 747.
You could probably fly as well.
What would my pronouns be?
Just get a couple Jumbo. Of LSD suppositories. Go for a fly.
I don't actually think he's saying that all you have to do is believe, because that's a little bit too cliche. But for him, for someone
who is... Is that all the bumblebee does? Is the bumblebee just an idiot who believes it can fly? It's the only way that it's existed through its entire species history.
Maybe.
It's just full of hope and dreams. Is that what you're saying? I think the bumblebee is just...
It's full of so much hope that the hope is what's keeping its wings in the air.
It's a deluded extremist who believes it can fly, but it's really just a dumb fat insect. That's what you're saying.
No, the point is, as he was saying from this scientific perspective of, you know, like, it's all dismissed. No, that's scientifically impossible. But he's saying that, you know, using the metaphor of the bumblebee is like, nothing's impossible.
I heard someone describing that while ago on a radio show, talking about the way snakes move and that it's not understood.
Really?
It's still not understood how a snake uses its body for locomotion. Like, yeah, we can see it. We can see it move. We can see it pushing along.
But it's hypnotic, isn't it?
If you break down, like, its muscle like the structure, and it's not well understood how they actually move.
Yeah, actually, interesting. That's really
just
cool.
Just like the bumblebee. The
it's
snake,
on hope. It's
just
fueled
a
on hope.
Dumb, idiot serpent who thinks it can move. It fully believes it can move, so it can. There's a lesson in that for everyone.
There is a lesson in that.
A lesson in that. So we'll link to everything in the show notes. Should we link to the man bullets?
Oh, why not? Yeah, we'll chuck them in.
Put those in there.
Yeah.
Some people will buy them.
Oh, they will.
Put in an affiliate link. That's it for this show. Thank you so much for being on Plus. Check out the show notes for all that good stuff, and we'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. See you then.